I just want to mention that we are still waiting on a few members because the Measure 37 discussions went over a little bit, but because we have a lot of people here who want to testify, I will go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 707A, actually, and I would like to ask Representative Scott Bruin to come up to the dais, and thank you for coming today, and I apologize, I was corralling
the lunchroom. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Scott Bruin, represent House District 37, which is Tualatin and West Lynn. And I'm not speaking to the Senate bill itself, but I merely want to introduce the Dash 13 amendments. Hopefully you have those. This has come very quickly to me. In fact, only in the matter of a couple days, a constituent by the name of Julie Parrish, who's sitting right here, and you'll have an opportunity to talk to her later, came to me and said, you know, by the way, have you thought about this aspect? And what this aspect is, or what it would do, is simply exempt schools, to put it as simply as possible, exempt schools from complying under the bottle bill, whether the current bottle bill or what's envisioned in sort of the enlargement of the bottle bill under Senate Bill 707. Ms. Parrish, her expertise in this area comes from the fact that she's been food directors, nutrition directors for school districts, and she brought something. She reminded me of something that very strongly came to my attention as I was working in a different committee on the school nutrition bill, which is the tightness in the budgets of these school districts with their food programs. There's no profit here. These school districts do their best. They manage these. They do a great job of managing to basically break even. And so the point that was brought to my attention is if you add a nickel now to these, you're significantly increasing the cost of their school lunch programs. Right now, most of these schools, first of all, they don't use cans. They use in all the drinks they serve are pretty much entirely in plastic containers, whether it's milk products or water products or juice products or whatever the liquid beverage is. They get great discounts on these because they can buy in bulk. They get special labeling rights, and in fact, even some of the schools have their own school logos on the water bottles and whatnot. And honestly, they can get the, you know, something that you and I would pay a buck or $1.54 at a grocery store for a bottle of something. These school districts are paying maybe 20 or 25 cents. Usually, they're a couple ounces smaller, but they're fairly inexpensive. If we add 5 cents to the cost of, and really, honestly, the schools don't have a method to take the cans back, the bottles back. So if we effectively add 5 cents to this without, and they don't have the ability to redeem and get the money back, it's costing these school districts an awful lot of money. There's no question that these school districts, without exception, recycle. So it's not a recycling issue. These bottles are now and will continue to be recycled. It's just a matter of adding an extra nickel cost or whatever however Senate Bill 707 ends up. And so they have asked to be exempt from this, and I think it's a good proposal. So the Dash 13 amendments take out public schools, they take out community colleges, they take out universities, and they take out the Oregon Military Department as well, which is the National Guard. National Guard has a school, as you know, in Bend, as well as, you know, as it was described when they're doing their training or whatnot. They go through a lot of water. They recycle everything. They don't have a mechanism to take bottles and cans back. So that's the request for the exemption. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the representative?
Madam Chair, just a quick comment, an expression of gratitude towards Representative Broom for bringing this amendment. It's an issue we heard about earlier, and I'm glad that you also have a witness and constituent who can tell us a little bit more about what's happening in schools. I think it's going to help us understand this issue quite a bit more. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative, she was on the list from last hearing, so why don't you...
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay, that's what I was saying. Yeah. Love to have
I do have a question for the representative, if I may.
Yeah, he's
Madam
not
Chair.
Leaving. He's just... Chair. Okay, Representative.
Representative Broom.
Yes.
Just curious. What does that say on the front of your shirt? There? Oh, the ducks. Okay. Thank
it
you.
Says ducks. Probably.
Okay. All right.
Representative Manager.
My name is Julie Parrish. Thank you for having me here today. I was a food service director in the Westland-Wilsonville School District. I am a member of the Oregon School Nutrition Association and credentialed through the National School Nutrition Association as a school nutrition specialist. I am also a family coordinator for the Oregon National Guard. My husband's a battalion commander in Forest Grove. And so in discussing this with my peers and some folks in the Guard, schools have... very finite budget for food. It's a very much a pennies game. Oregon schools, there's about 200 school districts in the state. More than half of them operate in the red, so they're already pulling general fund dollars. So to ask for a nickel on top of their cost of goods is a significant challenge. In fact, for the Beaverton School District alone, who they offer a bottle similar to this with their Beaverton School logo. It has information about water and why kids should drink water. And for them alone, and they're giving this away at lunchtime, it would cost $35,000. And statewide, it would cost schools about $500,000. In nickels to try and give kids bottled water. Oregon school kids have a right to clean, safe drinking water. A lot of the water systems are old in schools, so schools prefer bottled water, and certainly for emergency feeding, it's nice to have bottled water on hand. So an exemption for schools would be significant. Similarly, colleges and universities, schools have long been the proponent of recycling, and offering children a way to recycle bottles is a teachable moment that hopefully they'll be able to carry out into life as a future consumer and carry on recycling and those goals. So certainly, if you can support this exemption, I know schools will be grateful.
Any questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I really appreciate you being here because I've been thinking about this issue and trying to understand it, and I do have some questions. First of all, let's start with this. Are there any containers covered by the current bottle bill that are sold or given away in schools?
Currently, there are soda machines in schools. We know that. But the thing with those is they don't come through the food service budget. So a student who goes and puts a dollar in a soda machine, the soda company has kind of already figured out the 5 cents in their cost of goods and having that machine be there on site. So and then next to that, the soda company has put a container for them to just drop it in, and the soda company takes it back. And some of the testimony you heard last week about soda companies having exclusive contracts where, you know, they could manage the nickels. They're set up to do that, where the water's coming in from, like in this case, direct from the bottler, or it's coming in through a small distributor like McDonald Wholesale in Eugene, who doesn't have a mechanism to deal with the bottles, and certainly lunch ladies don't have a way to take them back to the Albertsons and get their nickel. So that's kind of a challenge. So does that kind of answer?
I think so. Maybe clarification, Madam Chair.
Clarification.
So let's focus on the part of the vending that food service controls.
This would come out of there.
That would come out of there. Does food service currently in West and Wilsonville, I suppose, where you're familiar, does it purchase any beverages that are covered by the current bottle bill?
No.
Okay. And your concern is that by adding water bottles, West and Wilsonville, for instance, would be required to pay that 5 cents to the distributor when they purchase the bottle, and would not have the ability to recoup that. Now, my question, I guess, is assuming that those bottles stay at the school, mm-hmm. don't go home, and the kids are encouraged to recycle, wouldn't those bottles end up in a container, a recycling container in the school that the school would then be able to ask the distributor to pick up and reimburse for the nickel?
Well, like I said, the distributors that they're currently getting from, I'm not sure what the mechanism that they're going to do to reclaim bottles for all their customers, let alone the volume that schools have. And if the distributor, for example, this gets delivered once a month, kids, 500 lunches a day going out of a kitchen, it's a sanitation issue of just having bottles accumulate and not go anywhere. Where right now they're currently recycling, and it will just go right with their curbside recycle and out the door to a reclaimer or whoever, wherever their PET plastic's going now.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair.
And Representative Burley had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that bottle have a barcode on it?
Absolutely not. They've saved the side panel has room for the school's marketing message, and in this case, this bottle has nutrition facts about why kids should drink water. So there is no barcode. And so this bottle is a private label for a school, wouldn't have a way to go back to the Fred Meyers or the Albertsons and get their nickel back in that situation. And a lot of schools are doing this. I think there's probably about 12, 15 districts right now who've just recently started doing this with their own art and their own message. And in fact, this school's bottle, they're actually asking parents to buy it, put it in the classroom, and have water available all day, not just in the lunch program. And so, you know, then asking parents to participate. I'm currently have 7 children in my house, so suddenly asking me for an extra $1.20 a case for 7 kids a couple times a month is going to be a challenge. So from that perspective, this, there's just no good way to get rid of this bottle except to recycle it.
It seems...
Follow up.
Thank you. I'm going to figure out how I'm going to articulate this. It seems to me that, you know, I've had quite a few conversations with Mr. Emery from Earth2O about this very issue, because he does a lot of private label production. And he has pointed out to me that that's very problematic in the scope of this bottle bill scenario. And I guess what I'd be interested in, and I don't know if you can address this or future witnesses or anybody, but I'd be interested in, you know, how do we deal with that issue? Because as we heard on Wednesday, as a result of a question of mine about how do you actually know how many bottles or cans there are inside those machines that rarely ever work. I'm sorry, I got to keep saying that because it's kind of a pet thing. But they're all scanned on the barcode. You take that and run it through there, and there's no scanning, so it won't even accept it. So how do we deal with that?
And it's going to be a challenge for any institution. I mean, Kaiser does a private label bottled water right now that I think it's Cedar Canyon does theirs. OSHU is looking to do one as well, but with the way this is written, that they would be exempt from that. So it's going to be a challenge for anyone. And a lot of these companies some of the companies who are doing private labeling aren't just in Oregon. So then to go back and track their business is just adding another layer.
Thank you.
I had a question. What's the ounces on that bottle?
That's an 8-ounce bottle.
8-ounce, okay. Mm-hmm. I know there's exemption for smaller containers, but I was curious about the size of that. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative, for bringing this forward. Appreciate you coming here today. Okay, with that, we are going to finish up the sign-in sheet from last Wednesday's hearing, and then we do have some new people signed up. So is Erica Hagedorn here from the Northwest Food Processors? Erica? Okay. She's not here. And I see Lisa Dotto that I saw. Lisa's not here either. Okay. And Paul Romaine is here. Julie Brandis. Julie? Or maybe outside.
She's there.
There she is. Okay, well, this is actually going to go quicker than we thought because a lot of people didn't come back. Okay. Thank you, Paul. You can go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I'm here to testify on all sides of Senate Bill 707A. Let me start with the problem. The problem is that you're trying to expand the bottle bill. And as you've heard from so many different people, the current bottle bill works because of exclusive territories. That's how it works. Whether it was designed that way or evolved that way, we believe it worked that way because that's how the system was set up before the bottle bill went into effect, and it made it easy transition. You're now trying to get product in that is not delivered in exclusive territories. So you have to solve the distribution problem if you want to do it. You can't just sort of wave a magic wand and say, bring them in. So what I tried to do is think about two separate issues. One of them is the distribution portion of it. Now, the easiest thing to do to solve the distribution portion is to mandate exclusive territories for anything that's in a bottle bill. A manufacturer can go and set up exclusive distribution systems throughout the state. And then you have somebody who's coming in and delivering full product, collecting the nickel, and giving back money when the product is redeemed. That's what the current system is. And that's the easiest thing for you to do. If you don't do that, then somehow you have to mandate that manufacturer or importer or wholesaler create some kind of system that acts to get that product back and get the nickel back to the consumer. And that's what Senate Bill 707 attempts to do. Basically, it says, without dictating the kind of system you have to put in place, it says manufacturer, wholesaler, importer, you have to figure out a system. It can be whatever you want. We're not going to tell you what the system is, but you have to figure it out. The second thing that we tried to solve was private label. Now, private label exists with soft drinks right now, and it's probably the least redeemed product out there. And this is your policy choice. Private label is already in a closed-loop system. It works very well with a bottle bill. If you have a private label at Frippy Frump's Grocery, and you buy it at Frippy Frump, and you take it back to Frippy Frump, it's all in one place. It's a closed system. The problem is the only place you can take it back is Frippy Frump's Grocery. You can't take it back to Fred Meyer or Safeway or Albertsons or any place else. And the beauty of the bottle bill, or the nightmare of the bottle bill, depending on which end you're on, is that it's everywhere. You basically have universal redemption. So if you cut down a number of places where you can take that bottle or can back, you cut down on the amount of redemption. Used to be that Fred Meyer and Winco took back everybody's product. They did it as a marketing deal. It's a good program. Till they realized just how much money they were paying out, and they couldn't get another retailer, a major retailer, is probably the largest private label retailer, to give them the money for the product they redeemed. So they were, in effect, financing that private label for the other retailer. So they now say, no, we will only take back that which we sell. But it used to be the retailers took back, or at least some retailers took back everything. So what we tried to do with this bill is say, all right, if you're going to be out there and you want a high redemption rate, and this is your policy choice, if you want the redemption rate to be high, you have to have numerous places to bring the stuff back. Now, a couple of myths out there. Or not myths, actually fact. 90%, approximately 90% of all containers that come back through the grocery systems, big, small, whatever, come back through reverse vending machines. 90%. That doesn't count the stuff that comes back through the bars and taverns, restaurants, things like that. But in the grocery area, 90% comes back. The distributors, we used to say that we basically complained for about 10 years, and then we tried to figure out a way to at least make this thing work. And that's why we set up things like Container Recovery and Broco and other co-ops. The mechanism is in the current bottle bill to set up co-ops at the retail level, to set up recycling centers. After Wednesday's hearing, I asked some folks to give me some numbers. If they were going to set up a recycling center, and we picked Gresham because within a mile, There are four major retailers out there. I believe there's a Fred Meyer, Safeway, I believe a Winco, and I believe a Food for Less. And the figure that came back with machines installed, with people manning it 16 hours a day, service, the whole works, benefits to the people who are manning it, the whole works, the cost came back under $200,000. Now, that does not include land acquisition, but it does include the basically building it and manning it, operating it. So what I heard on Wednesday is it would cost one individual store $200,000 to do it. Well, if four of them got together, maybe they each put in 50 and cut their costs $150,000. You can do this. What we did with Container Recovery in the Portland area, the complaints that came in before, when I first took over the beer and wine distributors, complaints on bottle bill were all over the place. It's a horrible mess in our distributorships. There's all types of fraud when we go to the grocery to pick it up because we're picking up bags and we don't know where the stuff came from. It's awful. Our trucks have to go out half empty because we have to pick up all the stuff. Our costs were astronomical and they kept going up. So what we did is we got all the distributors together and we sat down in a room, and I tell you, the first meeting was very funny, because everybody went around the room and everybody said why it couldn't be done. These were the lawyers who got together. You know what lawyer meetings are like. The lawyers said why we couldn't do it. And finally we got around and I said to everybody, you have to do this. Our clients want this done. And so we put together a system. that works, and it cut our costs considerably, because now we have one truck going out to pick up rather than 10 trucks going out to pick up. You save money by cutting some of your costs and pooling this stuff. The system can work. It's your decision. Our preference, and let me be very clear on this, our preference is you not include anything else in the bottle bill. You have a good system today. It works very well. And, you know, we worry when you get into other products. But we made a determination that there was a public will to put in something like water and maybe a few other things. And so our concern was, how do you make it work? And that's what we attempted to do. Is 707A a perfect bill? No, not even close. Do you need the task force, and should it be broad? Yes. Do you need to look at all issues, unredeemed deposits, everything else? Yes, you do. You have to look at the entire system. You should have been doing this over the years. But, and we will support you on it. But what we tried to do is craft a system that would allow you to take in a product that does not fit under normal circumstances. And that's what we have there. One little sidebar, it's interesting, I hear about the school stuff. It is very interesting, and I believe Bob Danko pointed this out on Wednesday. The bottle bill does not require a deposit. It requires a refund. So a distributor or a supplier supplying a school district could actually, or anybody, could decide not to take deposit money if they were assured that they were, in effect, getting all of the stuff back. So the fear is that you give 100 containers to somebody and you get 90 of them back, and 10 of them you end up having to pay for, but you didn't collect the deposit. That's the fear. But if you can be relatively assured that that system is a closed loop. Should I start dancing? Or?
That's my phone.
Somebody just ran off with your purse. So I would just. I would be too.
And they left the phone. Yeah. Anyway, that was a ploy to make me lose my track. Sorry, I get on a roll. But the idea of you can work within the system today to solve those problems if you so desire. The other thing is,
Paul, I'm sorry to interrupt, if I may, Mr. Vice Chair. Where you were was you were talking about that they don't have to charge the deposit,
right?
And I don't know if you quite finished that line of.
Well, what I'm with a school district or anything else you choose, if you are, and it would be an individual decision by whoever's supplying that water, if you are going to a school district and you're the one the school district is contracted with, and you are comfortable that water is going to come back 100% to you, there's nothing in the current law that would prevent you from, in effect, saying, I'm going to run the risk. I don't have to charge a deposit. Nobody out there today has to charge a deposit. They have to give a refund. My beer distributors could basically sell everything without a deposit. They would just increase the price 30 cents a six-pack, and there would be absolutely no deposit on there. They have to give a refund. So, thank you.
Where did Julie go?
Put her purse back.
Joe was out.
Joe put her purse somewhere.
Mark.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. Today I represent 7-Eleven. We also represent the Northwest Food Processors Association and Anheuser-Busch, which means on any given moment, on any given amendment, I have a conflict. Today, though, I want peer, not on behalf of Anheuser-Busch, but 7-Eleven and Northwest Food Processors. I'll echo a complaint that you've heard from grocers over and over, but it's particularly true for small convenience stores. We simply don't have the room. And for us, it's, and many of you have been in 7-Eleven stores, they are very, very small, typically 2,500, 2,600 square feet. And we just cannot handle, even with the small store provisions in this bill, we can't handle more product in our stores. We do, I should say, have a particular exemption. We only have to take back those containers or those products that we've sold. Moving to Northwest Food Processors, we, again echoing some of your other witnesses, the issue of what is flavored water is critical to us. We would prefer that you remove the reference to flavored water and that we're only dealing with water. And even then, we'd like to remove the reference to water. But you're not going to do that, I suspect. Again, we are working on trying to bring you a definition of water or of flavored water. That is very, very difficult. We're trying to be able to understand what you want to cover. In the Senate on the floor, that question was asked, and there was not a definitive answer given at that point because, quite honestly, I don't think there is one. We can't seem to find a federal definition, although we have a federal definition of water. So, Mr. Chairman, we're working on that, and we'll bring that back to you. Again, we would prefer that you eliminate the reference to flavored water altogether. Thank you.
Mr. Vice Chair,
yes.
I'm just curious, is this federal definition of water different than H2O?
Anything dealing with the federal government has a different definition, but Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, but it's a reference to the federal code.
And Mr. Nelson, my question is, with 7-Elevens are currently required to take back product, is that correct?
Only product that they sell.
Right. And that is up to the maximum, current container maximum per day, which I think is 120 containers?
Mr. Chair, 144.
So it's explain to me how this bill, Senate Bill 707, would be worse for 7-Elevens since the number of bottles they'd be required, containers they'd be required to take back would be fewer. Does this not address some of the concern that?
Mr. Chairman, the references in the bill is that you have given an exemption up to no more than 50 containers from one person. It's not so much that we have leagues of people coming in with 50 containers. I think and Mr. Romaine may have some better numbers. Quite honestly, we only take back about half of what we sell. Mm-hmm. Most of them do go to the larger grocery stores. But even half, and even up to 50, is too much. And when you expand to water, we simply don't believe we're going to have the space and with the added items.
Okay. Thank you, Julie.
Mr. Vice Chair, if I could jump in there a little bit too, I would also suspect that some of the concern is that we're taking out the size and brand, which means that those, you know, they are going to get more volume. That's one of the issues that grocers have as well.
Right. Not for small retailers, though.
I'll have to look at that. I'm not sure that's correct.
I think that in the Senate bill that we got, the small retailers are only required to take back size, brand, and kind. So anyway, we'll get to that. Julie, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. As a point of background, we do represent some of the nation's very largest retailers. Most of them are general merchandise or apparel retailers. I think in our membership we have one grocer. Obviously, AOI's preference is to continue to look at programs that are encourage our curbside recycling, and we were part of the rigid plastic container law that passed, and we worked very hard on that. And when we look at these issues, I'll just give a personal example. At Christmas time, we were up at the at Sun River, and we were reading in the local Sun River newspaper that they were thinking about getting rid of the recycling depot, the homeowners were. And to me, that is, you know, where something that's very important to recycling, especially in a community like that that's very small, that isn't, it doesn't have a curbside and shouldn't because they're vacation homes. But taking away something like that is where our focus should be in encouraging recycling. And just as one little example. Obviously, we have very large concerns about the brand and size issue. This requires retailers to take back brands that we do not sell, as you're well aware. And you've heard a great deal about this section. But keep in mind, our retailers are generally fairly large retailers. Our footprint is big. But we do not sell a lot of a great deal of soda or water. We sell saws. We sell lumber. But people come into our stores and they want the convenience of grabbing a Minute Maid lemonade or a Coke. And to have to start to work on our distribution networks, today we were operating this closed-loop system. Home Depot, I believe, works primarily, obviously being from Atlanta, works primarily in selling Coke products. So we have a closed-loop system, and we have established a business relationship with that bottler or the wholesaler. So now if Target or Home Depot or Joe's, we have to wait for someone to come pick up a Safeway Select. And our stores are big. I have no disagreement about that, but they're simply not set up for bags of containers waiting for another retailer. Now, I think the argument that I continue to hear a great deal about is, well, you all don't take back that much. True. That's a fair argument. But we do take back some. And we do store it for our distributor to come pick up when he or she drops off another container. Further, our apparel stores sell water, and we often sell branded water. And we will have to accept others' bottles. And clearly this will be very new territory for the retail community, the apparel retail community. They have no experience with the bottle bill, and the inclusion of other brands is just an additional headache. Once again, the argument I continue to hear is, well, you all aren't going to take back that much. And I would be very cautious about putting a lot of faith into that argument. And a very good example is Oregon's law that requires us to offer paper and plastic when we bag items. We have people call in often saying, well, I just got in trouble because I wasn't offering paper or plastic. They're not getting in trouble from DEQ. I'm going to make that clear because we've worked with Bob Danko quite frequently on that. But people expect retailers to comply with the law, and they make a big deal about it when they don't. So I have a very strong suspicion, because the way small retailers defined, it's defined by square footage. And Nordstrom's has a lot of square footage, but under this law, they'll have to take 144 water bottles back if somebody comes in and asks them to. And it's just very new territory for them. And I would agree with what Mr. Nelson said as a final point. I think the flavored water, obviously, we represent one of the companies that's in our membership is hiking and outdoor. I assume they would like a clearer definition on the flavored water. That concludes my testimony.
Questions for any of the panelists? Representative Burley.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I'd like to pursue this private label matter a little bit further. And I don't know if you feel comfortable answering, but why would private label, like that bottle of water we saw earlier, not have a barcode on it? And yet the Safeway brand of soda pop or the Fred Meyer brand of soda pop, I mean, they have barcodes on them. I believe they do. So when do you apply barcodes and when do you not have to apply them?
Mr. Vice Chair and Mr. Vice Chair.
Vice Chair squared.
Yeah, Vice Chair squared. It depends how it's sold. If it's sold as a part of a case, if the unit that's being sold happens to be a case, they don't necessarily, and the product within that case is not for resale, they're not going to have to put a UPC code on it, I believe. If it's individually sold, you're going to have a UPC code on it. But so my guess is they bought case lots that were marked not for, you know, don't break it up and sell it.
Okay. Another question? Mm-hmm. Thank you. The other thing that I've been trying to get a little better understanding of is this whole notion about these redemption centers, because as you pointed out, Mr. Romain, the law does say that any person may establish a redemption center, et cetera, et cetera. And yet it doesn't seem like we have a proliferation of these around the state. I also know from talking to folks in my district in Bend that do some of this recycling, that the transportation costs can be a huge disadvantage to them. Take, for example, glass. I understand that the folks in Portland have the luxury of having a glass manufacturing plant within a mile of their recycling, which gives them the ability to have some market access, but for glass to be hauled from Bend up to Portland makes it totally cost prohibitive. Mm-hmm. So if you could kind of discuss that a little bit, and why don't we see more redemption centers around the state when the law does provide for it?
Mr. Vice Chair and Mr. Vice Chair again. The first of all, the glass issue. I believe that there's some new markets that are opening up, but that's been a major problem around the state outside of the Portland metro area is how do you get rid of the stuff. And when I was assisting in crafting some of the stuff in 707, I actually asked for things like tea in glass containers to be excluded specifically, because we really didn't want to try and get back more glass, because it's really a pain to try and get rid of. So I agree with you. There needs to be more creative uses for that product, mm-hmm. like roads in a landfill or things like that. I'm not sure if DEQ now allows that or not, but we have to get more creative with it. But it is a pain to get rid of the stuff. I believe part of the reason why that retailers have not co-opted to set up redemption centers is sort of marketplace considerations. First of all, I mean, getting the distributors to do it was a royal pain. I got sick of getting the phone calls and people complaining, and that's all they were doing is complaining. And so we actually went out to Iowa, New York, and God, you didn't want to go that route, and Massachusetts, and looked at some sort of preliminary systems that they had put in. And then we came back and crafted ours, which actually works. And it benefited the retailer, because the retailer went from having to do sorts to commingling. It worked extremely well. So we tried to create something, and we had to create the leadership to do it in the first place. And the incentive to do it was to cut costs. It wasn't to make money. The gods are speaking.
The energy.
I can't tell you why individual retailers, maybe they're far more competitive with each other and they don't like to talk to each other. I don't know. Maybe they're looking for other ways for people to finance the system to help them put it together. I don't know. But I know that the system without a bottle bill costs the distributor less than the system with a bottle bill, and I know that a system without a bottle bill costs the retailer less than a system with a bottle bill. And what we did is trying to cut our costs further. When the bottle bill went into effect, everybody raised their prices. Distributors did to cover their costs. Retailers did to cover their costs. Nobody is losing money selling this product. That's what you do in business. If it costs you money, you raise your price. So I can't tell you why. Maybe they're looking for somebody else to be compelled to put in money to help them do something. But I can run a business model where they can make a lot of money or save a lot of money simply by going to this system. Now, there was one point that was brought up in another meeting by retailers about how do you force certain retailers who don't redeem very much into one of these co-ops? And that's an interesting question, because there are some very large warehouse stores which sell huge amounts of product and take back very little, without mentioning names. And so if they can basically dump all their costs onto somebody else, that's a pretty good thing for them. Why should they? If you're buying pattern or redeeming pattern isn't to go there, why do it? And maybe you do need to tweak the law to somehow require them to come in, or maybe the marketplace would require them to come in effect, because consumers would demand it. I don't know, but that is an issue that you should look at. But the mechanism has been there. I can't tell you. You should ask the retailers again why they haven't done it.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm struggling with the language of Section 2 of the bill, and the changes in on lines 15 to 18 of page 2 as compared to lines 25 to 28. Now, what lines 15 to 18 do is they make a change in the law, which now requires a dealer, meaning a retailer, to pay a nickel deposit on containers of the kind, size, and brand sold by that retailer. So if it's not, if it's a strange brand of water, for example, if water were added, I realize it's not in the bill now, but if it were added without making this change, then the retailer could refuse that bought to pay the deposit and receive that container. But the proposal is to strike size and brand. So if I sell any brand of water, then I have to receive water on any brands. That's my reading of it. But then I compare that to what's being said in lines 25 to 28 about manufacturer, distributor, importer. It looks like there's no obligation to take from retailers beverages that containers that are that they're stuck with, that aren't theirs received with a deposit. But I'm also struggling with 25 to 28, the fact that it says refers generally to manufacturer, distributor, or importer shall ensure that all dealers in the state that sell those beverages are paid the refund value. I'm struggling with how we can tell any individual distributor that it has a collective obligation to all dealers in the state. So just, can you help me out with this? And I throw that out to the panel.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative McPherson, first of all, a couple of things. First of all, the word sell in line 26, hopefully when you receive some amendments here, will say redeem. That was an error.
Oh, I see.
That was not caught until too late. And there's actually method in the madness, and it's not the method that a lot of folks impugn to us. When I first drafted this thing, we basically had everybody, manufacturer, distributor, importer, collecting anything, and retailer collecting anything. And then we realized that if you did that, in effect, you would let off the hook those importers or manufacturers or distributors who really didn't set up a system to collect. And you would basically give them a huge economic advantage over the ones who actually had systems set up to collect product. So what we attempt to do here, and we might not have done it artfully, and again, we wish that this had more venting in the Senate, but the attempt here is to say to everybody, if you're bringing product into the state, you have to have some kind of system set up to get that product. In other words, you probably will have to join a co-op, contract with an existing distributor out there of Coke or Pepsi or beer or whatever, depending on what your product is, somebody who's going to go to all the different outlets who will pick up the product, because you have the obligation, and if you don't, you will get sued under Section 7. That was the theory. Again, the drafting of this was kind of, let's get it done, let's put it out there, and if you have a better idea, we would love it. But that the whole theory is that you don't want to, you want to make sure that those people who are just directly importing the product into the state, or those who have 25 different means of getting into the state, have some kind of back-end system, because that back-end system is what makes the bottle bill work. You have to put them in a position. You can do it by mandating exclusive territories. I come back to that. We know that works. So you didn't leave.
I was going to say, right? Did I miss anything? There's the same three people, but what I left.
saw somebody walking
word.
Around with their purse, too. I
thought
but maybe
anyway, that's what we're attempting to do there.
I thought maybe you solved everything.
Follow up if I could.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Romain. It does help to have the sell be placed with redeem. But does that mean then that the intent behind the language with that substitution is that anybody who, say, I'm bringing my own brand of water into Oregon and distributing it around for sale, does that mean that I have an obligation as an importer of water or distributor of water to receive any category of water, brand of water bottle, or do I only have to take my brand of water bottle back?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, if you were a importer, manufacturer, or distributor, you would have to get your brand from that outlet. And again, that would force you to set up some kind of system, and more than likely it would end up being a co-op system. But, and again, if otherwise, when it was my first drafting of it was the other way around, and it just left too many people off the hook. So that's why we did it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
Can I answer a question that came earlier? Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I heard you ask a question about the coming up with working with the redemption centers. And I think that question was discussed the other day in the hearing with one of the grocers. And what I sensed, and I honestly, because a bunch of my retailers are going to be brought into the bottle bill, I've learned more about the bottle bill in the last 2 weeks than I've ever known. But I think what I sensed from the comments is grocers have been placed in the position of setting up a system that is expensive. They've put in, especially in the last few years, many of them have put in these costs into they put money into purchasing these reverse vending machines, and those have been expensive. And then if there's another system or another concept developed, such as the redemption centers, that's also another expense that would fall upon them. And what I heard them say is, can you help us with that? And I'm just going off my memory. I wanted to make sure that I spoke to that. I thought that was I didn't hear them say that it hasn't ever been discussed. I just think it's actually the cost of the system they've invested in and possibly a new system. And I don't represent grocers. I'm just trying to do that from memory.
Thanks. Can I just get one quick follow-up to Mr. Romain? Do you have a sense of how many containers you and the distributors you represent handle per year?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I really have no clue of the total amount. My distributors are beer, and I think we're maybe 15% of the total. I wish we were 50%, but we're not.
And Madam Chair, could follow up, do you have a sense for Crink, which you helped set up, how many containers they handle?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I believe that Crink handles about a billion?
$200,000 a day.
200,000 containers a day?
Right.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, Representative Burley, do you have a final question?
Madam Chair, do we have anybody signed up to testify today that is from the recycling business, whether it's Crink or somebody else?
We do not. We could call up Crink, I guess, if we'd like to hear from him, but I'd like to get through the list first, because
sure.
We have quite a few.
That's fair. The reason I ask, Madam Chair, is, you know, you'll recall on Wednesday we were given this document about Portland starting this new recycling methodology, and I looked at the language in the bill here under Section 8 regarding the task force, and you know the charge to the task force you'll find on lines 29 through 31 on page 5 says that they'll study beverage container collection and refund matters, including alternative collection methods to increase the recycling of beverage containers. And I would submit that we actually ought to expand the purpose of this task force to look more holistically at the entire recycling stream, because we've got paper materials, we've got this, we've got all sorts of things that wouldn't be beverage containers. And I think it's incumbent on us to take a more holistic look and see if there's not something else that may improve on the entire recycling stream in a more holistic sense.
I appreciate your comments, Representative Burley. I would ask Bob Danker from DEQ to come up to address that, but I'm not going to do that right now because we have other people to testify. But I do know that DEQ does have other task force working groups that look at other elements of the recycle stream. So maybe if we have time at the end, I can ask him to come up and address that. Thank you. Okay, next I'd like to ask Lynn Lundquist, Alex Kyler, to come up, please.
This is what I was looking at originally.
And actually, let's see, there's somebody else.
I see what you were talking about.
Ross Rosette. Lynn, why don't you get started? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. We have been very supportive of expansion of the recycling efforts. I guess I'll put it that way. It's part of our legislative agenda that we gave to all of you early on in the session. In that particular agenda, we did mention that there's a need to try to get these containers out of the stores in the long run. So I want to say that up front, that we think in the long run there needs to be a movement to make that happen. At the same time, we want to increase the recycling rate. And I happen to have served on the task force on the Senate side, the work group, I guess, on the Senate side, when we were looking at this. And I see this as a step process. I think in the legislature we often go through that it's we want to go to the end product, but a lot of times you can't get there without taking the step. I see this as a step towards a significant increase in the recycling containers in the state. There are those that would say this bill doesn't go far enough, and that's sort of one of the questions I'd like to address. It doesn't go far enough. It doesn't bring in enough. In that work group, and OBA's position to start with was we want to go to redemption centers. That was our original thought was. In fact, I've been had that in my own personal mind for a long time. But the more you look at that and look at the complexities of that, not only from how the system works, but financially how it works, it is a very complicated, and it takes, a great deal of study in order to get to that point. So our position at this point is, yes, this bill does go far enough. This is a step process. I think Mr. Romaine talked about that a little bit. This will require a change in the collection system and distribution system. And I think this gives us almost, not complete use of the term, but a pilot program almost. In other words, without bringing this whole series of containers, this will force the system to look at other alternatives and hopefully work out some of the kinks in that process. Anytime you change from an exclusive territory that our present model is under, we are going to have some changes, and it's going to be a cost. And I think you just need to be upfront that it will be a cost in implementing that. I'd just like to close by talking a little bit about the intercommittee, and Representative Burley talked about that in order to maybe broaden that. I think that's probably the most important part of this bill is the fact of having an intercommittee that is designed not to bring the groups together to say why the system doesn't work or can't work, but bring the system together to say we are going to move to an expansion if we can decide a process and define a process that will allow that to work financially for the retailers and the distributors and the wholesalers involved, and provide a better method of recycling, a higher degree of recycling for the consumers. I think whoever puts together that workforce in the interim is really a key ingredient of the success of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate your comments.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst with the City of Eugene.
As an aside, I'm the former chair of the Association of Oregon Recyclers. Prior to my current position, I ran the City of Eugene's regulatory program providing oversight for curbside recycling in the city. Just very, very briefly, our position on Senate Bill 707 is that we support Senate Bill 707. We do note that from our legislative policies document, Eugene City Council has a statement in that policy document about capturing unredeemed deposit money. This has been an issue that has come up time and time again with regard to Oregon's bottle bill. There's been several legislative attempts to try to even just track that amount of money, and so we would support any amendments that would examine either tracking that fund or best case scenario having the state capture those funds and then reinvest them back into recycling programs. I wanted to note that California's program was brought up in the hearing earlier this week, and that state does capture unredeemed deposits as well as assessing a handling fee to manufacturers. This came to my attention because I'm actually chairing a committee that is looking at how we put on a green Olympic trials in Eugene in 2008. The track and field trials are coming to Eugene. And when I talked to the folks in Sacramento who had done Olympic trials prior to ours and asked them about their recycling program, they indicated that their California Youth Conservation Corps provided all the recycling program that they needed for that event, and the funding came completely out of the Department of Conservation, funded through the bottle redemption system down there. So that's a fairly intriguing part of that program, in that they do plow a lot of money back into recycling infrastructure development, public education and marketing, and then this kind of large stadium and special event sort of recycling efforts. I wanted to take just a moment of your time to talk about my perspective from a local government curbside operator. The Vice Chair Burley talked a little bit about the Portland Recycles Plan. The City of Eugene's had a commingled recycling program and a biweekly yard debris program with carts, a cart-based system, for the last 4 years. It's very much like what Portland is going to. Springfield's got the same system without the yard debris collection. But local governments, by and large in Oregon, have kept glass separated from other materials on the curb, even when going to a commingled system, because of the concern from the paper industry about contamination from glass products back into paper fibers. This has been an extreme expense to them as they process newsprint and cardboard, and most material recovery facilities call paper fibers the bread and butter of their operations. So we tried to design, and I think most local governments in Oregon have tried to design programs whereby that value can be retained, even though it ends up costing the system more, and that those costs are borne by the ratepayer. We see an improved or expanded bottle bill as a way to maximize two systems that march kind of hand in hand. One is a container-rich redemption or deposit system, and the other is a fiber-rich curbside recovery program. And I think those two things really are complementary. They're not in competition. And I'd note that Oregon's curbside systems have existed side by side with the bottle redemption program for many, many years. There's a lot of folks out there on the end users, the paper manufacturers, the plastics recyclers, the steel recyclers, who really value the fact that Oregon has kept those kind of streams separated. And so if you have any questions about curbside recycling, especially, I'm happy to answer them.
Yeah, okay. And you may want to follow up with Representative Burley when he comes back. I think he had a few questions. Okay.
For the record, my name is Ross Rosette, and I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Bottled Water Association and also as a small business owner myself. Just to speak about some of my concerns on this 707 bottle bill, I've been working pretty hard for the last few years to, make a profit as a small business person in this in the field of the bottled water. And if the deposit is implemented on these the water bottles that I sell, some of the distributors that I go through aren't Fred Meyer's or any of the big major supermarkets. They're small C stores. I've talked to a few people that own these stores, and they say they probably wouldn't want to deal with any of the smaller private label bottles, because you can go in my area where I distribute, then out of that you probably wouldn't be able to return that, so they probably just wouldn't accept or, you know, wouldn't be buying my product anymore, which would basically put me out of business. Another one of my concerns is that I'd sell small bottles in both Washington and Oregon. If I have to redeem these from the stores that take them back, that sell my product, how do I know which ones are coming from Washington and which ones from Oregon? Another aspect that I'm a little concerned about is we do a lot of private label for like car dealerships or fundraising for graduations. Do I pass that on, and am I going to have to take back those bottles and refund the deposit? It's just a whole bunch of complicated you know, issues that I think is end up costing a small business person like me a lot more than just the 5 cents that's put on it in the first place. And to tell you the truth, I don't really think I can afford to hire somebody to go through all that, or to have to travel, say, to the coast to pick up bottles that came from a store in the Columbia Gorge that I sold them from in the first place. How are those bottles going to get back to me? So those are some of my concerns there. And I think there's probably, you know, 20, at least 20 people in my position in the state.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you coming to Salem today. Any questions for any of these panel members? Representative Cannon?
Madam Chair, thank you. I wanted to ask the last gentleman who spoke, what was the first, could you explain the first concern again?
Some of the smaller stores that I deal with would not want to purchase our product because they would have to take it back. And if the stores that sell it can only take back the products that they sell, I don't think a lot of people would want to buy that, knowing that they're going to be leaving the area and not being able to get a return on that, because the stores that they would say if they went from the Dalles to Portland, they wouldn't be able to return that bottle. Stores in Portland wouldn't sell my product, refusing to, you know, refund the bottle.
Any other questions? Did you have a follow-up, Representative?
Just a comment that my understanding of 707 as we have it here is that consumer who buys at the private label from the small store, mm-hmm, in your neck of the woods would be able to return it to a large store in Portland, say. Now, the challenge would be for you to be responsible for picking it up.
That's right.
And refunding the grocer.
I can't afford to travel to, say, Bend to get 24 bottles.
Right, and I understand that concern.
The store that refunded the money on those bottles, would they lose the money there, or am I, you know, by law supposed to go all the way there and pick it up? You see the logistics there?
Yeah, I do, and thank you for sharing that.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Alex Tyler offered to give you any questions about curbside recycling.
Oh, yeah, I know. They just want all the money. I saw that.
Okay. Jason Roberts. Rick Hater. And Brian Flaherty. Thank you. You can state your name for the record, please.
Thump, 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 thump. My heart's going a mile a minute. My name is Jason Roberts. Myself, my father, and my mother own Cedar Canyon Bottled Water in Forest Grove, Oregon. And it's a pleasure to be here today. We primarily do private label bottled water. We also do the 5-gallon home and office delivery, just like the bottles you have here on top of the cooler. And I come to you today with just some questions, some concerns that we have on our end as the manufacturer. Just a quick background, we've been in business for 13 years. My father started it up. We have 33 employees. We're out of Washington County. And we have about 300 different labels that we do each year actively. And we do
We do labels from Space Age Gas Station, Beaverton Elks Lodge, Albertsons, Lexus of Portland. I mean, you name it, there's a label out there. A lot of our water is sold in the Western States region. We'll sell 20 cases. Somebody will order 20 cases and have it shipped to Idaho. Siusla High School down on the coast, they'll order 60 cases. They'll pay $250 in shipping to get it down there. And then one of our questions is, how does that come back to us? Do we need to travel to the coast to pick up those bottles? Is the customer paying a shipping cost to ship empty bottles back to us? Same with that customer in Idaho. If we ship them 20 cases and I charge deposits on that, how are they getting those deposits back? Just the cost alone, if I go to the store and I pay $1.29 for a 20-ounce Pepsi bottle and I pay a 5-cent deposit, that's not much of a hit. But when I'm selling a case of water for $5 wholesale, and then I've got to add $1.20 on top of that, that's a pretty large increase in just the basic cost. And just human nature is the more it costs, the less interest you have in it. We support recycling 100%. We just want to make sure that we're going to be very efficient in how we do it. One of our questions is, if somebody comes up to me with a bag of water bottles, do I need to take all the bottles, even if they're my competitor's bottles, if I didn't charge the deposit, but I'm getting it back from where they bought it somewhere else? That gets into the whole redeeming only what you sell. The other question we have is, what about donations, freebies? If I donate a case of water for whatever cause with no deposits paid on that, does that customer then have the right to come back and get the deposit money back? Just a question. We donate quite a bit of water, especially, you know, for whatever reasons. School districts, disasters, the local fire department, whatever it may be. I just worry that if it becomes too complicated, it might drive the small guys away, the small local bottlers. If it becomes too much of a headache, they might say, you know what, let's just change our focus and just go straight into 5-gallon home and office delivery. And the fewer local bottlers that you have on the shelves, it just makes more space for the national guys to come in. Not a big slam against them, but I think we all like to support local and have something homegrown. So that's pretty much it for me. We just have a lot of questions on how it's going to be implemented and how the redemption aspect is really going to take case. Do I need to drive 40 miles to go pick up $1.20's worth of deposits? Is the customer going to pay money to ship empty bottles back to me? That sort of thing. So thank you very much. That's really all I have to say.
Great. Thank you. I hope your heart is still going
okay.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rick Hader. I am the general manager of Culligan Bottled Water of Portland. We're a small family-owned business. We're a locally owned franchise of Culligan. Culligan, you'd recognize the name as a globally recognized name. We're a locally owned franchise of that name. And the majority of our business is home and office delivery business. And interfacing with that is the distribution of small packages of water that would be affected under this bill. The channels of distribution were addressed earlier with the problems associated with open channels, and that's where I have some concerns, because as we deliver 5- and 3-gallon bottles to homes and businesses, it's not uncommon for us to deliver a few cases of smaller packaged water products, both with the Culligan label on them and others that are private labeled, and the problems that we have are twofold. The problems that were just addressed by my colleague at Cedar Canyon with, you know, the logistics of the whole thing with the collection and redemption of deposits are vast. But in addition to that, we're distributing a food product that is difficult to control contamination with on our 5- and 3-gallon bottles. And so in the redemption phase, when we're picking up these containers, the small packages are not treated the same as the larger packages or containers the water is packaged in. So there's a sanitation issue, and there's also a logistics issue with not room on our trucks to pick these up and bring them all back. So we have some issues there that we're concerned with. We take a lot of strides to make sure that the 5- and 3-gallon packages are produced and manufactured and used in such a way to keep contamination from occurring in the reuse of those packages. Another issue that we have is we happen to be located very close to the Columbia River, and the close proximity to the state of Washington allows us to be a logical place for people with another, quote, Culligan label to come across the border and want to redeem that from us, and we may not have much way of knowing whether or not it was a product that we sold. You know, if we take that combined with our open channels of distribution, we are distributing within the state of Washington, but there are other Culligan dealers in those areas that also are doing the same thing. So it's very difficult for us to track that situation. I also have some problems with, I think, the proprietary nature of the bill looking only at water. I'm visualizing a time when we have private label tea, you know, and what happens then. I also, part of our business, we are also in the water treatment business, and I can see where the pressure on small business to do this may lead somebody like ourselves away from that small package business and more into water treatment devices for people. And then the intent of being able to collect these deposits may not be present as people move more and more toward filtration devices or systems where they can filter their water instead of buying that product off the shelf. That's certainly a threat to the bottled water industry each and every day. I do think that competitive forces here are against the small bottler, and I have concerns with competitive advantage that way. We wouldn't be able to afford to partner with another distributor to pick up our packages and return them to us. And to be quite honest with you, they end up all over the place. And I think if something were done in terms of the recycling issues, I believe that's really where the problem is. And it's my opinion that this bill is kind of a Band-Aid to fit the larger issues of the recycling problems. And I'm hoping that the committee really looks at that issue more as we get into this and that's really kind of the gist of my questioning or my concerns regarding the bill.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming here today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Flaherty. I'm the national guy that some of your Oregon bottlers have been talking about. I'm the Director of Public Affairs at Nestle Waters North America. And in this area, you probably know us by our Arrowhead brand, bottled water, and also Calistoga. And I'm happy to have a chance to come and talk with you for a little while. I have submitted written testimony for the record, and I won't read it. And would like very much just to highlight a couple of common themes that I think you've heard today, that I've heard sitting here today and learned from, and maybe a few others that you may not have heard. Nestle Waters is the largest bottled water company in the United States, and as the largest company, we certainly believe that as a manufacturer, we have a responsibility for the product that we put out into the market and that we sell, and for the packaging, and we certainly believe and have done, and we think made some pretty good strides to exercise that responsibility in what we've done by reducing the amount of plastic that's put out in the first place. Over the last 10 years, we've reduced the amount of plastic in our half liter, which is the most highest selling package size, by 245 million pounds in the last decade. And by reducing the size on the label, we've shaved another 15 million pounds of paper. We right now have a half-liter container that's about 14.5 grams, and by the end of the year, you'll start to see a little change in your Arrowhead bottles and the Calistoga bottles, because they'll be going to one that is 12.5 grams, which is the smallest that will be on the market anywhere in the United States. And that's a start. We know also that, what do you do about recycling? And while we have done it, we will continue to do what we can to design our packages to perform best in a recycling system. We look at our experience across the country in terms of the three states that have bottle deposits on water, two of which I'll tell you just a little bit about, one being the state of Maine out in the Northeast. I'm from Connecticut. It's kind of in my neighborhood. And also California, which has a different program altogether. The concerns you're hearing about how bottled water gets to market have to do with everything that many proponents of this bill have talked about. People are drinking bottled water now like they weren't 36 years ago, excuse me, when Oregon passed its bottle deposit law. And that's absolutely true. And we get to market like cornflakes. We get to market in a different way in a system that we didn't so much design, but is one that provides for ease for the retail, our retail customers that that sell our product. And so when we deliver, for example, to a warehouse that's operated by a large retailer, and our invoice comes back with a bill of lading for the cases of the pallets that we've dropped off there, that is a point at which we lose sight of where those bottles go. And it has been our experience, and this has been borne out in Maine, where those retailers then, based on their own need, will then decide how many cases, how many pallets they ship, and that very often goes across state lines, goes from one place to another. In Maine, we have consistently had redemption rates over 100%. Last year, we paid out $815,000 more in nickels than were collected out of the Maine Nickel Deposit Program on our bottles. Our Poland Spring is our biggest brand there. The year before that, it was over $1 million. $1.4 million in over-redemption for bottles for which no deposit were paid. Now, there's two forces at work that way. In some cases, there are people returning bottles that they might have bought in other places and didn't spend a nickel on. And in other places, there have been water in cases that have been shipped up into the state of Maine by folks that retailers that haven't paid us the deposit. And so what happens is the consumer buys that bottle, he or she brings it back to the store looking for their nickel deposit that they paid at the point of sale, that ultimately comes back and becomes a cost borne by our company. And that's mostly because of that open system. And so while a lot of people have talked about it, I just wanted to at least be able to share with you that fact. And I've got the statistics on the second page of my testimony that it does in fact happen. Another concern, and I think it is when you look at the differences at how we get to market, that does represent in a bottle bill system a higher cost that we have to bear than, say, a brand of water that gets through an exclusive distribution territory, for example, from our two soda-based competitors. There are costs that we are estimating right now at anywhere from 35 to 70 cents per case that it will be more expensive to get us our bottles through that system through a third-party agent that we would have to hire and we'll have to hire to take those bottles back and to bring those back into the system. Puts us, even as large as we are, even as the bottlers here who talk to you that have a small business that's saying, you know what, we think the stores are going to say goodbye to us, or we're going to have to say goodbye to this part of the business because of the costs. We see, because of the way we get to market, a competitive disadvantage that we just kind of hope doesn't get enshrined into the law, whereby if I have a choice and I've got a product coming to me that's another brand of a bottled water that gets and comes and goes back or can more easily than we can through a closed distribution system, I wonder if I just find that's an easier place to sell. I will tell you that others who testified have had some, I guess, good luck by invoking Bob Danko's name, and I had a chance to meet Bob about a month or so ago at a meeting of the grocery manufacturers, and I heard the story of the history of this bill. And it was told with a great deal of pride. And I can tell you that my state of Connecticut followed, took us about another 10 or 11 years to figure it out. And we're one of the states that also has a bottle deposit on carbonated beverages, also has a proposed bill that pending right now that would put that nickel onto our product. And I would hope that as you look at this bill, and listen to some of the concerns about how there is a difference in how it affects us. We certainly, I'll say this much, even a risk not only coming in from out of state, but by saying that we have seen our experience in the CRV model in California that there is a system there that in some ways is a little bit more friendly to an open distribution system, is a little bit more flexible in terms of how the consumer is able to return those bottles and decide whether they want to bring it in to get the full redemption value or put it in the curb, and hope that as you look at this legislation and look at maybe some other ways, that there may be a way to put a redemption value to decide if you want to put the deposits on these bottles, to do so in a way that maybe works not in conflict with the other systems, so we don't have people coming up saying we have a special problem in schools, or we have a special problem if we're a smaller bottler, or we have a special problem if you have to put it on flavored water. So I want to thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for having given me the opportunity to testify. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the chairman? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Flaherty, can you help me understand the contrast between the open distribution and closed distribution? My understanding is that the two different systems we're looking at here are an exclusive territory system for that exists among carbonated beverages and a sort of open distribution system for water bottles if we add it. And those are the two systems at play here. So what are you describing when you contrast open and...
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, we get mostly to market through an open distribution system.
What does that mean?
Well, that means, and I should have put a map on here, but it basically means, as I was trying to describe, when we get to market, a bottle of Arrowhead gets on the shelves of a convenience store differently than it gets on the shelves of a grocery store. And in many ways, as I said, we're shipping direct to these large distribution centers operated by the grocery stores in the same warehouse with the cornflakes and with other grocery products, as opposed to through distributors. Some of our product, I think, probably does get through distributors, but the lion's share of it goes through a system where we then, as the manufacturer, don't control where those bottles go. We do have barcodes. That issue was raised before on many of our bottles. But right now, those barcodes don't exactly, they can help a store just, in a reverse vending machine figure out whether a bottle, that brand is sold in the store. But right now, our label would say, California redemption value, Oregon 5-cent refund. But it would not be able to tell in a reverse vending machine, not be able to tell whether a bottle was purchased in the state of Oregon or in another, in your neighbor to the north or anywhere else. That system is just not as conducive to tracking and finding and being able as a manufacturer to take our fair share and say, okay, this is how much we need to pay in order to take responsibility for what was sold in the state and where the deposits were collected. Now, I understand, I listened to Mr. Romain who talked a little while ago. He said, well, a long time ago, everybody raised their prices to cover their costs. And I just try and provide in this testimony, our costs are going to be competitively higher than those of some of the brands that get through a closed and exclusive distribution system. This is more than I ever really needed to know about it, Madam Chair and Representative, and I can expound on that further with you and get you more information. But the difference has shown us and has shown up as a major cost to our doing business through the lessons we've learned in Maine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Flaherty, just to kind of get into this in a little bit more gory detail, if you will. You manufacture Arrowhead, if I'm not mistaken. I thought I heard in New York somebody once told me. Is that correct?
No.
No.
No, Arrowhead is bottled in the state of California.
Okay. Well, same difference.
Poland Spring is our regional brand.
From New York.
Did I play you straight, man? Well,
the chair is from New York, so I take issue with that comment. Vice Chair.
I'm from the East Coast. But let's say that you ship from your facility in California, truckloads of this stuff to the Brand X warehouse in Spokane, Washington. Now, at that point, Brand X is not giving you the deposit because you're not selling into the state of Oregon under this bill. Okay, so now Brand X has possession of these bottles. Now, they're going to ship this stuff into Oregon. That's either going to go to their own Brand X stores, or maybe it's going to go to some, who knows, schools, hospitals, convenience stores. who starts that process? Where does that nickel start in that pipeline, and who keeps it, and how does it get back to where it belongs? You're out of the picture completely at that point.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, you're right. We initiate the deposit usually if we know a product is being sold in a deposit state. Then we collect that deposit up front when it is sold. When it is shipped to a non-deposit state, such as in your example, we rely on Brand X to tell us, at some point, match up the tapes and show this is what went here, this is what went there. We don't have the ability to demand that. And some, I think, have suggested that that is one inherent difficulty of the, I could get in trouble for this, but for the manufacturers initiating the deposit as opposed to it being initiated at the retail level or at another level where you can, as a state, audit sales tax receipts or do that. So we are getting better at it because it's cost us millions of dollars. We are improving our accuracy in Maine, but it has still been very costly. It has been very difficult, and we've had great success with some brand X's that are very, very good and easy to deal with. In other cases, we haven't.
One more question.
Sure. And Mr. Flaherty, in your written testimony, you twice make note of, in fact, you say that Nestle Waters North America has traditionally supported curbside recycling programs due to their ability to recycle more household products. And again, later on, you also highlight the fact that you feel that it gets all recyclables into the stream. So, you know, based on your experience in other states, have other states, I mean, Maine's got the bottle bill and all this kind of stuff, but have other states moved more towards this more holistic thing that you're referring to in your written testimony?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, yes and no. There are three states right now that have are moving, that have moved or in the direction that, that you're considering in this bill. It is very easy to come as a manufacturer and say, well, look, if you would just improve curbside recycling, everyone would be fine, thank you very much, and then go home. Our company, you know, and I also can't say here, and I say it in the testimony, bottle deposit programs move a lot of bottles, and they do have success in capturing bottles, and whether it's litter and then moving them in to be recycled. However, we just received in the state of Connecticut a fiscal note on their bill that it would remove $900,000 a year out of revenues coming from municipal curbside recycling. It one comes at the expense of the other. And the cost that we are projecting and that we're experiencing to our company in Maine have to do with accounting steps and driving extra trucks around to collect bottles, because the garbage trucks and then the recycling trucks are still going to be driving around collecting whatever is left at the curbside. All these different steps that don't have a direct impact on the environment. And so we have worked with many of our competitors. We've worked with through our trade groups and a group called the National Recycling Coalition, which are the men and women who do who run recycling programs in states, counties, and localities across the country, and come together to fund a project called the National Recycling Partnership. Now, unfortunately, that's coming along a little later than it really should be. But it was announced last October. It's doing two things. It recognizes that in order, you need an educated and motivated citizenry to know what they can recycle, where they can best recycle it, and it's going to rebrand recycling and keep that stewardship of the chasing arrows and the ones and the twos and the labels on the bottom of the plastic with the National Recycling Coalition. And it also will be performing four demonstration programs, recycling tune-up grants, if you will, to go in and say, look, we can have success in this city by collecting garbage and recycling on the same day, by making a recycling bin as large as the garbage bale, or even my pay-as-you-throw and a disincentive to just throw things in the garbage. So we believe and do believe that curbside recycling programs have that ability to have the rising tide lift all boats. And we're trying to put more than just putting our money where our mouth is, and you know, with other folks as well. That's certainly preferable. But again, I can't say that deposits don't have the ability to move those bottles. And I know that's one of the issues that this committee and this legislature are struggling with. And it, again, is one of the things that that CRV program and your neighbor to the south has had some, I think, there's some good pieces to that that help work. And that's my long answer to your short question, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before we bring up our last witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your testimony and your input.
Thank you.
Appreciate coming here today. Okay, last we have Jeremiah Bauman. And then is there anybody else who did not sign up on the witness sheet that would like to come up and testify?
I'm going to start charging.
Oh. Madam Chair, will you ask Mr. Romaine to cover? I can correct it here. He sent a note saying that Crink, in fact, processes 3 million containers a day, 5 days a week, about $750 million per year. I probably addressed 750 million containers per year. I probably addressed that question to the wrong person, but that's the right answer.
Great, thank you. Yes, when you got. And just make sure and state your name for the record, but Jeremiah, why don't you go first? And then just to note, we're going to leave a few minutes for Bob Danko to come up and address the question that Representative Burley had earlier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I've handed out written testimony, and so I'm going to just try to hit some points that I think are helpful given what I've heard. I'm also going to try to be brief to just leave time to respond to questions. There's been a lot of information. I think a lot of good questions have come up, so I'd like to take as much time as there is available to respond to questions from an environmental and consumer perspective on these complicated, remarkably complicated issues for what most Oregonians think is a remarkably simple policy. Let me first draw your attention to the back of this packet of charts I handed out. This is just some of these charts I'm not even going to talk about. They're just kind of interesting for information. On the back, though, chart label number 4, there's been a lot of talk about curbside recycling, and curbside recycling, of course, is very important. Osberg aggressively supports curbside recycling. The reason that we don't talk a whole lot about using it to solve the problem of 125 million water bottles going in to landfills is it just doesn't work that well for beverage containers. I think Representative Burley commented the other day that a lot of us, especially driving back and forth to Salem, stack up a lot of water bottles in the car and do use curbside recycling for them. But based on numbers, we seem to be in the minority. During the 1990s, which is when curbside recycling and recycling generally exploded in this country, the access to curbside recycling more than tripled across the country. At the same time, the recycling of beverage containers actually declined. The reality is people just, you know, don't bring those containers back home and get them in those bins very well. The bottle bill, on the other hand, is incredibly effective. Started off above 90% when it was established as the value of a nickel declined. It's now down right around 80%. Of course, there's different versions of numbers out there, but that's more or less the trend. In our view, there's two primary reasons, I think, that are helpful from a policy perspective that get at why the bottle bill is such an effective tool for beverage containers. One is the obvious one, the deposit. You offer somebody some money if they get it back to you. That probably works for a lot of different things. Another very important aspect, however, is the unique convenience of the return-to-retail system. That's partially because there are grocery stores so everywhere. There's one, you know, on every street corner practically in a lot of cities at least. And the smallest towns, of course, have at least some access to retail grocers. But there's a very unique form of convenience at play here. It's not just that there's one nearby. It's that it's a place the consumers already get going and likely going to be getting more of the same product. So it just sort of works psychologically and convenience-wise that you're going to that place already. So that, I think, those are the things to keep in mind about what works so well. And that also is partially why during the discussions in the Senate, the issue of redemption centers gets complicated quickly. Once you take that out of retail, it's very hard to provide that same level of convenience at any reasonable cost, to have that same number of redemption sites. And even if you got that same number of redemption sites, the unfortunate situation the grocers find themselves in is the grocers have already have the land and the building and the space, as difficult as it may be to manage it. So you're going to have a lot more cost to try to set up a parallel system providing the same convenience. And that's when you get into other policy questions to maintain convenience, like mandatory recycling rates, to force the right number of redemption centers, trying to figure out the magic number is for how close it has to be or how many they have to be. It gets complicated quickly. Now, it is true the grocers find themselves in the hardest place on the bottle bill because they're the ones who don't get compensated. That is completely true, and we're very sympathetic to that. There are two straightforward ways, I think, to deal with that, what other states have adopted. One is a handling fee that distributors or manufacturers pay to the grocer. So when the grocer pays the 5 cents back to the consumer, when that bottle gets picked up by the distributor, they're actually paying 6 cents or 8 cents to compensate them for their trouble and space and staff time and that sort of thing. The other method, of course, is giving them a portion of the unredeemed deposits, which has already been talked about. Let me getting at all these points, draw your attention to chart number 2 here, which compares recycling rates, unfortunately only through 2000. This is the best I could get that looked at multiple states. The interesting thing about this is, first, you can see how effective the bottle bill is. The bottom line on that chart shows you the national recycling rates for these containers that are just far below any state that has a bottle bill. That basically shows you the effectiveness of having a deposit at all. Then if you look at how these things are grouped, that top line is Michigan. You can see they're ahead of everybody by a fair margin. And that, in my mind, is the only difference between Michigan and Oregon, which is those three hovering X's there, is that they have the same redemption system, return to retail, but they've got a 10-cent deposit. So that means that that's probably the primary difference there, is the increased deposit value. And then Oregon is ahead of the rest of those states. And the primary difference that I can see comparing all of their laws is that Oregon maintains the return to retail convenience, and the rest of the states have some kind of redemption center system or other system that, you know, for better or for worse, requires the consumer to take that extra trip to a different place. You know, the one idea I'll throw out that was discussed a little bit in the work group would be sort of a hybrid, splitting it right in the middle, which is having redemption centers outside of grocery stores, but outside of grocery stores only insofar as in the grocery store's parking lots. Basically at the same site, but managed in a way that is a lot less hassle to the grocery stores, might solve some of the grocers' issues while maintaining that same level of convenience. Let me just talk about two other issues before I wrap up. Two critical things I want to point out in SB 707. One, it's really important when you add water bottles to make this change that is proposed in here, which is eliminating the brand and size restriction. The reality is there are just so many more private label water bottles that you're going to have a lot of problems for consumers if they can only take that brand back to the same place that brand is sold. There are just so many brands that are sold in so few places, it gets into a real problem. So that is incredibly important, I think, from making this program work. And I think, honestly, it also forces the system, which is how the whole bottle bill got started, is the people that are responsible for these containers had to go out and figure out how to make it work. I think it actually creates a problem for them to go figure out how to get it all back lined up. And I'll talk about that a little bit in wrapping up. The second thing I do want to point out, one improvement we would suggest for SB 707 is that it changes the definition we've had for 36 years, or the application to plastic bottles, and it now restricts it only to PETE plastic bottles, which it's true is the vast majority of the beverage containers in plastic that are sold right now. But I don't think this is experienced this phenomenon. Once you start working on this bill, you start finding yourself picking up every container in the grocery store every time you walk in. There are actually a decent number of bottles out there that are not PETE, and I don't think we want to have recycling be the basis, a recycling policy be the reason people start choosing different plastics to avoid refunds. And so I think it's important that any plastic container, because we know plastic should be recycled, be covered under the bottle bill. Let me wrap up by talking a little bit about this, I think, complicated and thorny issue of the mechanics. There's this complication between the closed-loop system of mandated or non-mandated, in the case of carbonated soda, exclusive service territories that are a voluntary choice by most of the soda companies. It is one thorny issue you've got, because you got moved to water where, you know, I think the example you used the other day was that Arrowhead has 16 different distributors and doesn't actually track that closely who's doing what where. It is complicated. There's also a further level of complication when people start bringing every brand back to a grocery store, but it's a little unclear what happens to them from that point forward. I agree it's complicated, and I agree it's messy, but in my head, I mostly step back to a 30,000-foot level on this issue. The people who created the bottle bill here in Oregon would be pretty surprised that there are this many people buying water in plastic bottles at all to begin with. It's kind of a bizarre thing we've got going on here. I mean, from a personal note, looking at the economics, I'm not sure if we're buying water that happens to be in plastic or plastic that happens to contain water. So I'm sorry it's complicated, and I'm sorry it's going to cost a few million dollars for Nestle. On the other hand, it's a pretty big problem, not just that we've got thousands and thousands and thousands of empty water bottles sitting on our beaches, but plastic is a petroleum product. This is a global problem we've got right now with dwindling supplies of oil, increasing prices, and increasing demand for oil. And I think the people that are making money off of selling us water in plastic bottles have some responsibility to step up and figure out how to make this work. And I look back to the founders of the bottle bill who saw the same thorny, complicated mess and didn't know what the distributors were going to do with all these bottles and didn't know how they were going to get picked up. And they said, we're not going to get government involved and create a complicated government program trying to mandate who picks up which bottle and who has to get the one from Bend to Hood River and who gets the one from Hood River to Portland. We're going to say you're going to collect these bottles back and you're going to give consumers a refund and you go figure out how to make it work. And last time the legislature did that, it worked, and we had the most effective recycling program in the nation. So that's the approach I would urge this committee to consider as you move forward looking at these questions.
Thank you, Jeremiah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Murray, and I'm Vice President of Business Development for Far West Fibers. Far West Fibers operates two major recycling facilities in the metro region, and at any given time handles between 40 and 55% of the state's curbside material. I'm sorry, Representative Burley's not here at the moment, because one of the points I wasn't originally planning to testify, but one of the points I wanted to address is the impact that may be felt if the bottle bill were expanded to add water bottles, how it would impact the curbside material and the value. In the year 2000, we, in the commingle that we were processing, approximately 2% of that material was plastic containers. Today, it's over 5%. And this is by weight, which is an incredible volume. And primarily, by far and away, it's water bottles that have added to this. The purpose of the curbside program is different than the purpose of the bottle bill. The bottle bill was put in place for litter and continues to help to get rid of litter. I don't look at the expansion of the bottle bill, especially with only a nickel, to be of any big significant impact on the curbside and the value of that material, and the value is important to us. We think it's far more important that we look to capturing more of these containers and to clean up the litter that's in the parks and on the sides of the road. So that was one point. The other point, I wanted to echo what Jeremiah just said regarding only including PET. I would suspect that if there is a more cost-effective alternative material such as HDPE or some other material, if I was packaging water, I'd probably move to that and not have to worry about the bottle bill. So I would say that you should not limit it to just PET. Okay. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Jensen and then Representative Burley have been favoring this side of the dais, and they've been awfully quiet down there. It's Friday, I know.
Madam Chair, it strikes me from looking at Jeremiah's charts and graphs that he brings to us that we're putting a lot of time and energy here into a phenomenon that is declining in its importance and significance as far as American society is concerned. If you look at his charts in the period from 1990 to 2000, while Michigan has a high rate, there's about a 5% decline. While Oregon is the parent of the bottle bill and is probably somewhere close to motherhood and apple pie as far as this particular issue is concerned, we've got over a 5, probably around 5.5 to 5.6 or so percent decline in Oregon. In Massachusetts, we've got 10%, give or take some change. In California, we've got somewhere in the 18%, plus or minus a little bit. And as far as the nation is concerned, 6% approximately. So over this period of a decade, We've seen, you know, given that there's some anomaly of maybe in taking place in California, the governor that was elected on one thing, one stand, may have changed his position, and that may have caused a whole bunch of different problems. I don't know what that, you know, is. Maybe it was that they were trying to be grandiose with their law and do something that, you know, was more. But the pattern seems really consistent here over the decade, about a 6% decline in. I'm not talking about the merit of the bill that we're, you know, or the whole issue of water. I think a couple of thoughts about water as such. I mean, we keep talking about flavored water. Madam Chair, I'd suggest that all water is flavored in its pure and natural state. Water is has no flavor. And all of it that all of these people peddle to us has had something added to it to give it some sort of flavor. All of that aside, there may be a deeper, bigger problem here that somewhere needs to be investigated and looked at. And it's why is America becoming, statistically, this will be significant if we look at it, you know, statistically. Why is it becoming, you know, less enthusiastic, less inclined to seek redemption? Not because of the nickel versus the dime, because the dime is also losing at about the same rate. And Madam Chair, I'm not speaking to or against the bill at this point. I just find it really fascinating and interesting that this is what the pattern or trend is, and I'd like to know more about that.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. We appreciate those philosophical discussions, and I'm sure we'll have more. Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on my very good friend and colleague from northeastern Oregon, I would submit maybe $4 a gas is a good reason not to be redeeming this stuff.
Is that going to come in plastic bottles?
Madam Chair and colleagues, committee members, I just wanted to point out that we do have written testimony here from the International Bottled Water Association that just kind of starts to touch on this question that I was following up on a little bit with Mr. Flaherty about where the nickel really starts. I think it's important that we spend a little time and think about that, not here necessarily, but I do call your attention to the last two pages of this where they have a little chart, and this was kind of the questioning that I was following. You know, what if it's made here and it's shipped there and sold this way? And it can be very, very confusing and convoluted. So I just wanted to call that to your attention. And then lastly, also follow up on comments, Jeff, that you had made. And I, you know, I certainly can't argue one way or the other what the value of this stuff is in that curbside recycling. You guys know that better than I do. But all I ask is that, and this is, I guess, one of the luxuries I have because I don't have the Oregon DNA. So I can ask the critical questions here and say, is there a world after the bottle bill in Oregon? You know, and, you know, Jeremiah, I truly appreciate the bottle bill and its significance to Oregon, but there is a much larger waste stream out there, and I don't care if we're talking about beverages or litter or whatever the case is. I pick the stuff up when I'm walking around the river fishing all the time, you know, and pack it out. So my question is, how do we look at that more holistically? And that's something I really do want to take a look at and hopefully get Mr. Denkel up here and discuss that a little bit more with respect to this task force.
Thank you. And I hope you don't want to pump your own gas as well, because that's the other part of the Oregon DNA.
Yeah, don't get me started.
that's for another committee. The chairwoman happens to be sitting up here that I had to sit through. But anyway, I appreciate
that issue this year.
Smoky Bear license plate.
Yeah,
that's right.
I appreciate your comments and all the comments of the committee. We are just about out of time. I don't know if we would want to bring up Mr. Danko for just a couple of minutes, or we will have. I think what we'll do is, because it's the late time and we've had a long day, I think what I'll do is close this public hearing and we'll have some more discussions. We will be holding work sessions hopefully later next week. We do not have, because this committee has been working so hard, I am going to give them a day off. So Monday we have no
committee meeting. You heard it here first, folks. And we will be back on Wednesday with some informational sessions and work sessions.
Sure.
And before I gavel, Representative Jensen.
I had something I wanted to say, but you kept going on and on.
I would never be accused of that. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 707 and close the House Energy and Environment Committee, and have a good week.